Welcome to Interpreter Roundtable. This is the roundtable on Lesson 17, talking about the Sabbath day today. For people that are conversing with us, I'm Brad Gardner. I'm out in New Mexico. To the left on the screen is Ben McGuire in Michigan, and to the right, Andrew Smith in California. So, welcome to all. Ben, start us off, would you please?
Well, today's roundtable is largely going to deal with Section 59 of the Doctrine and Covenants, and in a way, this is about several of the commandments and the way that the early church was supposed to understand and practice them. This was, for the most part, a revelation given in August of 1831, and if you'll notice in the chapter heading that we have. It says that it was given in Zion in Jackson County, Missouri. And they had just consecrated the land, it says, and dedicated a site for the future temple there. Now, just as a quick aside, this is kind of an interesting thing. There were, you know, by the time they leave Missouri, they actually had several temple sites. My dad always used to kid around a little bit when he was living in Missouri for a while, and I think he moved there in 1973. He was in a branch of the church. He lived in a small community named Cameron. But within their branch boundaries, they had actually two dedicated temple sites and no temples. Their branch had the temple site at Far West and then the one at Adamon Diamond. But it says that the land was consecrated as the Lord had directed, and the site for the future temple was dedicated. And we're going to jump down a little bit. And start reading from the section. We're going to read the first few verses here. It starts off, "Behold, blessed saith the Lord, are they who have come up unto this land with an eye single to my glory according to my commandments. For those that live shall inherit the earth, and those that die shall rest from all their labors, and their works shall follow them, and they shall receive a crown in the mansions of my Father which I have prepared for them. Yea, blessed are they whose feet stand upon the land of Zion, and who have obeyed my gospel, for they shall receive for their reward the good things of the earth that it shall bring forth in its strength." And maybe it's a good place to stop right for a second, but you'll notice in verse 3 it says, "Blessed are they whose feet stand upon the land of Zion." That's all of them that are present, right? Because this is Zion. They're standing in Zion. They've consecrated this land. So this isn't a future sort of event that they're talking about. This is referring to them collectively, the entire congregation that's there, and all the saints that are moving to Missouri, right, are trying to build up the kingdom there. And while we know that they didn't get to stay there, that second verse is very interesting too, right? Because it says, it distinguishes between those that live and those that die, right? In a sense, we're talking about this expectation that the millennium was right around the corner, that the second coming was going to happen, and that some of them there believed that they would see the second coming, and that some of them wouldn't make it, right? It reminds us a little bit of Paul in the New Testament when he writes that the great day is coming when those of us that are still alive will rise up to meet Christ and the resurrected saints descending, right? He fully expected too that it was going to be within his lifetime.
And fortunately, in the modern world, we never had the problem in the ancient world where they decided to stop working because there was no purpose in it. They might as well give up their jobs and wait because the second coming was going to be that imminent. Fortunately, they didn't do that.
We've had some millennialist movements that have done that in the last couple centuries. But
even here in northern Michigan, we did have some billboards that said that the end was, what was it, last August? If you remember that group. Anyway, what I find is interesting about this now, though, is that we're talking about this idea of the second coming, and we've just consecrated the ground. And I know I'm repeating myself a little bit. They've dedicated a site for the temple. And in a sense, they're now asking the Lord, what is it that we need to do now to make this happen? You know, they had this real belief that they could make the second coming come sooner by fulfilling all the prophecies leading up to it. And I think that what we see in the rest of this section is is their first shot at a set of commandments and how to live their lives appropriate to a millennial group, right? This is how we become righteous. We've sanctified the land. How do we sanctify ourselves? How do we sanctify the people? From our own perspective, what we're really looking forward to is the temple. And they haven't gotten there yet. They understand they need to build one, and they've dedicated this land for it. But they're still working towards understanding what that really means within the scope of the gospel. And so we have these commandments, and I know that that we're going to talk about those in just a minute. But verse 4 says something very interesting, and this maybe will lead into the next group. And they shall also be crowned with blessings from above, yea, and with commandments, not a few, and with revelations in their time, they that are faithful and diligent unto me. They see the blessings as part of this crown, right, as part of their reward, and they see the commandments that they're going to receive as part of this reward also, and revelations. So there's three parts to this gospel that they have: the blessings that they're going to receive, the commandments that they're going to receive, and the revelations that they'll receive as they find themselves faithful to the blessings and the commandments that they've gotten.
And I think kind of an important point there is they really did have this millennial expectation. They really did think that everything was around the corner, and that by doing certain things they could hasten that day. And they were looking forward to it. Obviously, we know that a little bit of time has passed since then, and most of us are not really looking forward to that day at all. I would really much prefer to spend a lot of time with my grandchildren. But I think the difference is that although we don't have the expectation that the event is coming for the entire world, I think we need to remember that there is an event coming for all of us when at some point in time, sooner than the millennium, we will personally be standing before the Lord and taking into account. And all of these things that they needed to do to be worthy of their expectation of the millennium, we need to do also to be worthy of our expectation of standing before the bar of the Lord. I've had several people ask me about, trying to teach lessons on Revelation. I have to confess to them it's my least favorite scripture, because everybody wants to talk about end times. And the real import of all of that isn't something's happening, get ready for it. It's there's something that is guaranteed that's going to happen. Get ready for that. Live your life the way it's supposed to be lived. And if the millennium comes, that's fine. But
well, and I think appropriately, we can read this in a different way too, right? In verse 2, for those that live shall inherit the earth. I think that we see that now more in the sense that that if we live in the Lord, right?
Yeah.
If we're born again, inherit the earth. And if we die, it says we rest from our labors. But I think that other part is also significant to us, right? Our works follow us, which says a great deal about the judgment that you were referring to.
That's
applicable to everybody, not necessarily the way they would have read this, but everybody dies, and many of us can live.
Yeah, and just to sort of put the point on it, not so much that our works follow us in that they will determine our reward, but that our works follow us in that they determine who we become.
Yes.
Our works celestialize us. They don't qualify us for anything. They don't earn us anything. But they teach us how to become that kind of a person. I think that's the important part there. All right, anything else we ought to cover on that, or Andrew, we're on to you?
You talk about that other way we could possibly read it about those that live righteously. If you're reading it that way, then those that die shall rest from their labors. It seems perhaps a little prescient on this is years and years before the expulsion from Jackson County. I mean, 1831, the Saints, they're not even to Kirtland yet, right? Yeah. They haven't built the Kirtland Temple. They haven't built other things. And so can you...
Yeah, and that great line from Come, Come, You Saints, and, If We Should Die, before our journey is through. Yeah, that one hadn't been written yet, and yet they were getting this kind of a message.
and they're getting it. And as well, just thinking about that in the social context, you know, there's a lot of utopian movements and millennialist movements that are popping up all over the United States at that time, and a lot of them seem to take the idea that we can build up to creating this utopia. But it's very clear from here, from verse 4, the things that are going to make this happen, like you said, the millennial age that will come, it's going to come down from above. You know, we work and we do things, but we're expecting the blessings, the commandments, the revelations. This is really kind of a top-down utopian vision for what's going to happen, and we need to be ready for it. And I think that's still pretty applicable to us today, that, like you said,
I think it takes time for them and time for us to learn that lesson, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To yes. learn to see commandments as a blessing, to see commandments as a crown, and then to receive our own revelations, our personal revelation, and see that is the blessing that we're looking for.
Definitely.
Yeah, I'm not sure I've ever known a teenager to say, all these commandments you put on me sure are a blessing. Not sure that they've learned that at that point in time.
It takes a little while to mature into those positions.
Quite a bit. I'm not sure I've got it yet, so.
Yeah.
Andrew, you have some things to...
Yeah, still sticking with those verses, like Ben was talking about, that this is a way that people see of now we need to qualify the saints, we need to sanctify ourselves and move that way. I'm struck with the connections, and maybe the resonance is the way to say it, between these first few verses and the Beatitudes, coming from the New Testament in Matthew 5 or Luke 6, but perhaps more in common with Matthew 5, where Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth," and so on and so forth. And again, you have these first verses where it's, "Behold, blessed, saith the Lord, are they who have come up into this land with an eye single to my glory, according to my commandment. For those that live shall inherit the earth." And you have a lot of usage of that type. Again, in verse 3, "Blessed are they whose feet stand upon the land of Zion, for they shall receive for their reward the good things of the earth." You have a lot of this New Testament type language applied to this idea here in section 59, speaking of, you know, here it's not necessarily the meek, though you could say that it's the same people. It's those who have come up with an eye single to my glory. They are the ones who are going to inherit the earth, starting with Zion. And it's an important aspect. And that New Testament type language permeates, again, talking about the blessings and the crowning, goes back to both in the Sermon on the Mount, chapter 5, verse 10, "Blessed are they who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you, shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." And a lot of these blessings as well also have their resonance with the blessings that are outlined in the book of Revelation, John's Revelation. And then Apocalypse, the crowning as an enthronement in chapter 3 there, but also, you know, giving a crown of life. Whereas here in verse 4, what are we crowned with? Blessings, commandments, revelations, these kinds of things. And essentially, kind of essentializes a lot of that temple imagery coming out here. And this, you know, fits well in this section, as they've just dedicated the land for this temple. They're fully expecting the kingdom of God to come down, that they will be set in, sit upon the throne as joint heirs in Christ. And, you know, this New Testament terminology and phraseology is very apparent in the way they're seeing their mission here to building Zion.
Yeah, and we've seen that New Testament references and sort of paraphrasing and quoting and sometimes almost at random in bits and pieces where the New Testament's being quoted. And I think that we just need to underscore the fluency that Joseph had with the scriptures, particularly the New Testament. in at least the things that I've read and I've seen, he's much more frequently quoting the New Testament than the Old, even if the Old Testament might have been the original source of it. He'll quote the New Testament version of the Old Testament. And I think the other part of that fluency is not just that Joseph Smith is fluent, but that his listeners are sufficiently fluent that they will hear it and that they will understand all of these allusions, and they're with him. They understand probably much better than we do how those things are all connected.
Well, and you know, by August 1831, they're pretty deep into the Joseph Smith translation, aren't they?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that that had some impact. Another thing that strikes me a little bit as we talk about this is that the Beatitudes are not all friendly, right? We get to the bottom where it says, blessed are they that are persecuted for my name's sake. I think that we're also about to enter that stage of persecution. They haven't really seen much of that yet.
And yet here they're told.
Summer of 1831, but they're about to.
Some people are going to die. And it'll be okay when they do, which, you know, maybe it's consolation.
And this is the kind of thing that they probably don't look at and understand very well.
Mm-hmm. But
it's there to prepare them.
Yeah, certainly the kind of revelation that you understand in retrospect rather than as a revelation of what's going to happen. You kind of skip that part until you go, oh, yeah, that's what they were talking about.
And we've only gotten through the first four verses.
Yeah. Andrew, you had some more?
Some more thoughts just moving into the rest of this section. You get to kind of what I've termed, I don't know if anybody else has called it this per se. I'm sure people have written on this somewhere. I'm just not pulling the citations out right now. But verses 5 through 10 is basically what you can kind of term as a Mormon Decalogue, a Decalogue having reference, of course, to the Ten Commandments. And as we look at this, there are a bunch of things that jump out. I guess we'll read it real quick, and then I'll go over some of it. It says, "Wherefore I give unto them a commandment, saying thus, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy might, mind, and strength, and in the name of Jesus Christ thou shalt serve him. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Thou shalt not steal, neither commit adultery, nor kill, nor do anything like unto it. Thou shalt thank the Lord thy God in all things. Thou shalt offer a sacrifice unto the Lord thy God in righteousness, even that of a broken heart and a contrite spirit. And that thou mayest more fully keep thyself unspotted from the world, thou shalt go up to the house of prayer and offer up thy sacraments upon my holy day. For verily this is the day appointed unto you to rest from your labors and to pay thy devotions unto the Most High." Now, looking at this as somewhat of a version of the Ten Commandments, there's definitely things that jump out immediately. The thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, those parallels. But looking at it, especially trying to connect it back to this time the Old Testament phraseology instead of the New Testament, there are some major differences. First of all, it has a lot more in common with the Ten Commandments as they're found in Exodus than the reference that is found in Deuteronomy, repeating them. The reason for that is mainly that the reason for the Sabbath day here is connected more strongly with creation rather than with the Exodus out of Egypt. So Exodus 20 has a lot more to say than Deuteronomy 5, I think it is, where they're repeated there. But going through here, then you have, depending on how you tease these out, you have the number of commandments. Love the Lord thy God, number one. Serve him in the name of Christ. Love your neighbor. Don't steal, commit adultery, kill, nor anything like unto it. And then thanking God in all things becomes a commandment.
That's particularly interesting. I don't remember any other time. I mean, we're encouraged to be thankful, but now it's a commandment that we be thankful. And I don't know that we ever think of it that way.
Yeah, and it will revisit that when we come back in verse 29. But then it comes back up and ends with, after offering sacrifice, the tenth one is to offer the sacraments upon the holy day. So when we're looking at this, it looks like a version of the Ten Commandments that are being re-given by Revelation, but it's specifically been Christianized, meaning it's seeing the Ten Commandments distinctly through the lens of Christ's teaching in the New Testament. So you love God, you love your neighbor, the two great commandments, but how do you do it? You serve through Christ. And then the next four are sort of the ways that you love your neighbor. But there are some interesting things removed. So there's no commandment to honor your parents. And what that means is perhaps anybody's guess. I don't have anything specific, but it may be speaking solely to the time. But then again, you have additions, things that are added in. The commandment to give thanks in all things, as well as offer Christian sacrifice. Again, a distinct Christianization of these ideas. But then the bigger change in my mind that plays into the rest of what is going on in this section is the order is changed, where the Sabbath day is moved from in the middle to the end, probably for emphasis and for moving it to become the subject of what the rest of the section will be about. And now, as opposed to in the original Ten Commandments in Exodus, there, the one that is referred to as the command with the promise is again the honor your parents. Honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long in the land. Well, here, it's the Sabbath day that becomes the command with promises. And all through the rest of the section, there are major promises, things for keeping unspotted from the world. The blessings and the fullness of the earth will be yours. Again, connecting back to that inheriting the earth and idea. And going through all the rest of the blessings that pop up through the rest of this. Just an interesting thought that the Sabbath day then becomes very important in this section and is supposed to be very important for the Latter-day Saints, given a lot of emphasis here, as well as the blessings that will come from it.
Yeah, and just to put a point on that particular verse, it says to offer up your sacraments on his holy day. It does not say to offer up the sacrament.
Yeah,
and certainly we are to offer up the sacrament, but there's a wider meaning there. Do you want to take a shot at that one?
Well, I think of sacraments, you know, in perhaps the parlance of the time. I haven't checked that in the old dictionaries, but it probably has more of a reference to ordinances or rituals enacted in the name of God and for those purposes. That's how I read sacraments. Maybe that's a little too close to perhaps a Catholic rendering of sacrament as the things you have to do.
One thing I see there is it talks about the house of prayer, right? Mm-hmm. Which we typically read today as going to our local ward meeting buildings. But they were still meeting in homes.
Or outside.
Right. Yeah. And this house of prayer, really, at least at this point, they take it to mean the temple that they've just dedicated mm-hmm. the ground for. And only later do we really start to differentiate as we build buildings, right? Which, to some extent, you know, we start seeing in Kirtland and moving out, but we really don't get into full swing until we're down into Nauvoo.
Yeah, and late Nauvoo, because a lot of what's happening in Nauvoo is still that mixed-use building that Kirtland was. Mm-hmm. Because Kirtland, in addition to a more sacred ground, was a meeting house. So rather than the kind of temple that we have that has access through your righteousness, this was access to pretty much anybody. It was their chapel as well as their temple. And so some of that moved a little bit, but the house of prayer still had that connotation, and it was in that context. If I remember correctly, later in the dedication of the Kirtland Temple, where they're speaking of specifically as a house of prayer. Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess there's one thing that I wanted to point out when Andrew was talking about the connections to the New Testament language. We've got verse 1, and there's a phrase in there that bothered me for a number of years, and having some kind of an answer to it, I'll pass on what I've learned about it. And if somebody else was trying to figure it out, now you know. but it says that we should have an eye single to the glory of God. And I, for the life of me, never could figure out why an eye single really would make a big difference to anything, especially since the vast majority of people have two eyes, and having a single eye doesn't seem like it's that great of an advantage. So I asked way back when my Greek professor what that meant, and he said, well, I don't really know. He said, basically, he says, the eye single means unmixed. And I couldn't figure out what the unmixed meant. And the only context that I've been able to find out about it, and Ben, you'll check me on this, the ancient concept of the eye was a little bit different. We understand the eye as a receptacle for light. They understood it as a projector of light, and so that the light would come from the inside out. And so you would have the eye being the lamp of the soul, or the place where the light comes out. So you would have darkness in you or light in you that would come out through the eye. And the unmixed talks about the wick of the lamp and the quality of the light that's coming out. And if you have impurities in the wick or in the oil, then it flickers and you don't have a good solid light. So an eye single to the glory of God is more pure. And that's sort of a pure devotion to God, I think, is what's behind that phrase, rather than anything about eyes and binocular vision or monocular vision.
Right. Some sort of metaphor or idiom.
But based on a concept that we don't use, which is the eye projecting rather than receiving light.
Well, and you know, the early saints took that to mean more of that idea of being devoted to or dedicated to that glory. But that brings up something really interesting, because, you know, we talk about mixed metaphors and so on here. I really love verse 17, right, where the Lord says, yea, and the herb and the good things which come of the earth, whether for food or for raiment or for houses or for barns or for orchards or for gardens or for vineyards. These are the things that they worried about, right, that they needed described in those terms. And so we get this New Testament language, and side by side with that we have the good things of the earth that they need to build their barns with. Some of it is taking them back to their scriptures, and some of it is looking forward to the things they're really praying about every day.
Yeah, right.
So
here,
I enjoy this language.
Yeah, right here, as I said, this version of the Ten Commandments has a lot to do with the creation. I think that what you said is correct, but it's also overlaying it kind of on a reversal of the creation. Like 16 goes through the fullness of the earth, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the air, that which climbeth upon the trees. And
all the things that God ordained for the use of man, that's right.
Yeah. And it starts though with the beasts, and then it moves back to the plants. And moving kind of back, all things which come of the earth and the season thereof, etc. And I don't know if there's something there, but it seems kind of like a reversal of
even
moving back to the Garden of Eden kind of idea.
Even in verse 18, right?
Yeah.
Both to please the eye and gladden the heart, right? That's the tree of life, where the fruit was pleasant to look at, and so on. So, I think you're right about that. It puts all these elements back in there.
And it brings out a lot of Old Testament temple imagery moving on, for food and for raiment or garments, for taste, for smell. The idea of smell and tasting are heavily involved with the ideas of temple sacrifice in the Old Testament and moving forward that. The things that pleases God, the pleasing smell that moves up to the Lord and they offer things. So.
Well, and particularly remembering the context that Ben was pointing out, that this is a temple context, not so much in that there is a building, but in that there is a dedication. And so their thoughts and intents are toward the temple, and this language is clearly meshing with those thoughts and intents.
Yeah.
Where it ends up, right? We have these same themes coming out in their temple worship.
Mm-hmm.
And not too distant. But go ahead, Andrew, what were you saying?
I was just going to say it ends up in verse 22 with just kind of a "Behold, this is according to the law and the prophets. Wherefore, trouble me no more concerning this matter." And I kind of wonder if people were pestering Joseph or asking, you know, is it okay for us to do X on Sunday or Y on the Sabbath or what kinds of things? And he receives this answer, and it's just kind of like, you know, you guys know the law, you know the prophets, you've got this revelation, don't ask me again. You know what you're supposed to do. And I don't know if that's true or not. It always jumps out at me when I'm reading it.
That there isn't going to be reinstallation of the very strict Pharisaic laws of Sabbath, of what we can and cannot do on the Sabbath, which is probably a good point for us to mention that we're not going to prescribe what somebody should and should not do on the Sabbath. The Lord was sufficient to say, offer up thy sacraments and, you know, to keep it as a holy day. And I think we need to individually figure out how we keep that as a holy day. And I suspect that there will be aspects of that that are different from every person. But the commandment is still there to keep it holy in some way.
Right. And I think, you know, they're laying out broad principles here, but also, I mean, you go back to verse 11, and he wants to be very clear. Nevertheless, thy vows shall be offered up in righteousness on all days and at all times. He wants to make it very clear that this church is not going to be a Sabbath church. All of these things have to impact you on every day of your life, not just on the days that you go up and to the house of prayer or whenever.
And, you know, I think that there's also an extension to the whole idea of the Sabbath, in that we, at least in our theology, look at the whole millennial period, right, as a Sabbath. That's the day of rest when the Lord comes and reigns and makes it holy. And I think that to some extent they're looking forward to that too, right? But I think that, and maybe too, that's the don't trouble me anymore. Yeah. On this, right, you need to work it at the here and now and not worry too much about what's coming down the road.
And I think, you know, when you're talking about, you know, the millennium as the day of rest, I think one of the biggest problems we have in the church is we cut our phrases a little too short. Our sound bites aren't quite long enough because we call Sunday the day of rest. And there aren't very many of us that do a lot of resting on the Sabbath day. And, you know, bishops even less, and those with important callings in the church are going to spend a lot of time laboring on the Sabbath. And what it does is it says that you're to rest from your labors. So it's not that you're not supposed to be doing something, it's that there's a shift. There's something different. It's that quotidian life, daily life, that is supposed to be segregated so that you know that in spite of the fact that you know that you're going to be living the gospel every day of your life, you will still take time to perform some kind of special devotion on the Sabbath day. And I'll give you sort of a personal story from, you know, a decision that I made a while back. I remember being a graduate student working in Mesoamerican studies, and I heard the prophets say that learning another language or, you know, dealing with another language on the Sabbath was a good thing, and learning about history and other religions were good things to do. That's what I did every day of the week. And for me, I decided that it would be resting from my labors if I did not do those things. I'm a long way away from that now, and I earn my living some completely different way. And now I'm back to doing that kind of stuff on Sabbath because it is a rest from my labor. And I think a lot of what the Lord is looking for is understanding that there is a way to offer up our sacraments on that day and to make it a particularly holy day one way or the other.
And I think our sacraments are the things that we do in the name of Jesus Christ, right? Right. Our holy activities when we take care of those around us and provide service and as well as going to church and partaking of the sacrament, you know, and participating in our more normal Sunday routines.
Yeah, and in that sense, then, you know, what we're asked to do, you know, it does come out in verse 12. Remember on this, the Lord's day, thou shalt offer thine oblations and thy sacraments unto the Most High, confessing thy sins unto thy brethren and before the Lord. In that sense, you know, when we're coming up, what are our oblations? Those are the things that we give unto God. Those are our sacrifices. And so what have we been asked to do? It's the broken heart and the contrite spirit. And so instead of going up to the temple with your sheep to offer as a sacrifice, we're required to go and offer ourselves up before the Lord at his table, at the sacrament table, as well as working with the other saints. Those are things that are required of us, and that's how we offer our sacrifice now with a broken heart.
I think that puts us at a good place to end, and certainly at a time when we'd be looking to end. So we'll give our thanks to all those who are listening and watching. Thanks for Ben and Andrew for conversing with us, and we'll see you all again on the next Interpreter Roundtable.